Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Director of Mobile App Development at Simulation Curriculum Corporation, Tim DeBenedictis. Tim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, just having a good start to my morning here in California.
Excellent. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Oh, it's good to be here.
I've been following your products for a long time. I guess the listeners know that we're both kind of astronomy nutcases. And I wanted to ask you, how did you get started in astronomy? It's a very technical subject for a young person to get into.
Well, true, and yet it's also one that kind of, at some point, touches everybody. You know, my early memories are of things like going on camping trips with my dad, my mom. And, you know, one thing that you see out there as a kid that you don't quite see in the city is stars, planets. And my dad was an avid bird watcher, so he would, you know, carry around a bird watching telescope. And one of those bird watching trips, he happened to point the telescope at Jupiter. And, you know, I saw with my 8-year-old eyes Jupiter's moons through a little tiny bird watching telescope for the first time. And that was very, very, you know, very, very captivating. And I just sort of kept an interest in it. At one point, they got me a telescope, you know, of my own. And I would spend, you know, endless hours trying to find things as easily as my dad could find them. And most of the time, just getting frustrated and failing, but just hitting the target often enough.
Yeah, what kind of telescope was your first scope?
Oh, this was probably, it was a 4-inch reflector of the kind that you can now buy from many vendors for like $100 or $200. It's just enough telescope to show you, you know, the moon's craters, Jupiter's moons, just a hint of Saturn's rings, maybe the Orion Nebula, if you know exactly where to point it. But it's just enough to whet your appetite. And, you know, look, I was also a nerdy kid. My dad got me started in programming on our family's Apple II when I was, maybe 8 or 9 years old. And in fact, some of those interests combined, like some of the early programming exercises he gave me were things like writing a little gravity simulation to follow the paths of two binary stars around each other. Or to compute what would the Big Dipper look like if you were, you know, many, many light years away on the other side of the Big Dipper. So astronomy, math, and computers, and nature, and out-of-doorsiness, and hiking, and all of those things had been a part of my family for a long time, really since I was a kid, and that's how things got started.
That will do it. That's a great combination. I remember the first time I ever looked at Saturn through a very small telescope, very tiny, sort of expandable, you know, little refractor I had. Mm-hmm. And that got me really excited. And I went out and bought the parts for Edmund Scientific 4 1/4-inch reflector. I had to save up my allowance. And each week I bought another component until I had everything all assembled.
Those are really good times, really good stuff.
Yeah, that was a great little telescope. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen stories in Sky and Telescope about somebody who saw Saturn or Jupiter for the first time through a telescope, and it launched their entire career.
Yeah, you know, this still happens to me now, actually, from the opposite end. You know, these days I live in the middle of San Francisco, which, you know, it's the kind of environment where kind of the only things you can see in astronomy are big, bright objects like Saturn or the, you know, the planets. And I still have a number of telescopes, and every now and then I'll set one up in the park outside my apartment here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people come by at all hours of the night, you know, adults walking their dogs, families with kids. And, you know, most of them, although they're very educated, you know, like social people, have never seen like Saturn through a telescope. And it's still mind blowing to them.
You would think that with all the access we have to the Internet and websites that cater to space enthusiasts and astronomy books available in bookstores, that people would have, you know, had plenty of opportunity to see what the nearby planets look like. But there's something about seeing the real light, about having that sensation of this, you're looking through a telescope, it's something real, it's out there, you're seeing it now, or as the light left a few minutes ago. And that just has a psychological effect on people that's profound.
Yeah, that's exactly what I get. That's exactly the reaction I get. And, you know, like you say, there are lots of websites that, you know, that show results from like the latest, you know, Juno space probe orbiting Jupiter, right? But it's a very different thing when you look at Jupiter with your eyeball and there it is. It's no longer this abstract thing that only NASA can do, and it's out of the reach of normal humans. It's there it is, you know, it's in your grasp. So
did this early interest extend to your college studies?
Yeah, I was a planetary science major at MIT. And I studied under a professor named Jim Elliott, who is he passed away a few years ago, but he was a really great influence. He ran the planetary science department. Professionally, he discovered the rings of Uranus, among other things. But he did a lot of work with students to just develop various student projects. One of mine, actually, for Jim, was to develop a small image processing program. This is in the early 90s when the transition from film to digital imaging was just really getting underway. And this program I wrote was to just do basic analysis of digital images taken from some of the early CCD camera arrays out at Lowell Observatory. It was a great experience, you know, for me going out to, I'd never been west of the Mississippi, right? So I travel from Boston, Massachusetts, right? Pretty much grown up my entire life in the Northeast. Traveling out to Lowell Observatory in Arizona was like being at the Grand Canyon. Flagstaff, exactly, right? And just being among professionals for the first time was really great. Sadly, though, although I graduated with a planetary science degree, most of my early career was nothing to do with planetary science. I held a number of just sort of grunt software engineering jobs at a number of companies in Silicon Valley around the time the internet was getting started. And really most of those were nothing to do with planetary science. It was like bank security, you know, network security. I did audio engineering for Avid, for Pro Tools, DigiDesign before they were acquired by Avid. That was a number of years. That was fun, but not astronomy, right?
Well, know what? What I found in my career is that some companies, when they're hiring software engineers, they don't like hiring software engineers. They like hiring physicists and astrophysicists because they know these people are going to write really good code.
Well, I like to think so, yeah. But, you know, look, for me, getting the experience of being in the quote-unquote real world was just as valuable, you know, in the opposite direction. You know, I tend to be kind of a math science nerd, so you're right. I do tend to try to optimize things as much as I can. But, you know, being a good software engineer is more than just sort of crystalline math thinking, right? It's familiarity with a large range of tools, knowing a lot about, you know, the different languages that are available and the strengths and weaknesses of each. You know, when's a situation where JavaScript might be the right answer as opposed to C++, right? Those are things you can't really answer unless you have exposure to JavaScript and
so
C++.
What languages, is C++ one of those languages you were learning in those software engineering jobs?
In, you know, 1993, yeah, that would have been one. You know, this again is when Java itself was new, right? When the first generation World Wide Web, you know, just started to take over, right?
Yeah.
So a different era.
I think it was about 94 or 5 when Java came out, and then the internet went public in around 96 or so, something like that.
That's pretty much the timing. I remember looking at my first, you know, web page on a Mosaic browser in 1994 over a dial-up modem connection at my roommate's apartment. We're like, yeah, this is cool. I wonder if this will take off. Well, you know, here we are now.
I was at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory at that time, and my Unix mentor called me into the lab, and he said, I want you to see something. And he had this Sun workstation with an early version of Mosaic, and he was saying, come look at this. I'm looking at a website in Germany. This is awesome.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So were you doing Macintosh development of any kind in the early years?
Yeah, I kept, you know, and this is in the days when clearly Microsoft was the dominant player, right? I kept a Mac around just to poke around with on a hobby basis. But, you know, for my paying gigs, it was always, you know, Linux. Well, actually Unix. I mean, Linux didn't really explode until later in the 90s. Unix development or a bunch of, you know, Windows development. But I, you know, I liked the Mac since Apple had run in my family since those days of my dad having me peck around at our Apple II. And I actually kept, I had developed a little Mac planetarium program, which I released as shareware under the Southern Stars brand name in, oh, geez, I think it was like 1995 or 96. You know, and at the time I'm 24 years old, I don't have the foggiest idea how to market anything. I mostly did it as a nerdly hobby project. But it was, you know, it was admittedly a fun sort of Mac programming gig that put together both what I studied in school and liked, along with some of the professional real world training that I got.
So the seeds are in place. I can see it all coming together.
Right.
So
exactly.
That eventually led to a more formal Southern Stars company. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So Southern Stars, you know, I'd sort of kept it around as a hobby, and it was sometimes more active than others. But things really took off in about 2008, 2009. This is like 10 years later now. When two things happened. One was, well, of course, the iPhone launch. And the second thing that happened, which really made this work, was a charting thing. And we decided, well, sure, let's give it a spin.
So in 2009, we have the ability to actually write native software on the iPhone.
Yes, yes.
And that kind of opened the doors for a lot of people.
Exactly. You know, I had this sort of small mountain of C code for astronomical computation, C++ code for dealing with the database aspects of it. And we sort of put it together, got it out on the iPhone.
So you converted all that astronomy C++ to Objective-C?
Well, we sort of took a bifurcated approach. Now, Objective-C can compile and understand C++, although not the other way around. So we kept my code as sort of the computational and graphics engine of the program, and then Bill did the UI in C++. You're writing to Cocoa Touch classes. And that approach worked pretty well.
Cool. So you launched Sky Safari for the phone, iPhone, in iOS. And as I recall, there was some initial problems with that. You had three versions you wanted to sell. Tell us about that.
Well, that actually came a bit later. So we actually started just with one, at the point, at the time, called Sky Voyager. And the biggest problem we faced is, just like any app developer, is that nobody has the foggiest idea who you are, right? It's a marketing problem. It's a business problem. It's not a technical problem. And, you know, at this point, I had a little bit of interaction with folks in the, you know, sort of the quote-unquote professional amateur astronomy world. I knew who most of the major telescope vendors were. I'd had some interaction with them. I knew who the editors of Sky and Telescope magazine were. Again, I'd had some interaction with them also. But, you know, just getting your name out there and letting people know that you have a cool app to download is a big challenge. You know, my first month of having our app on the store, I sold maybe 100 copies. It's pretty disappointing after having put probably 6 man months worth of effort and of our own time and blood and sweat into it. But we managed to, well, I'd say we got lucky. July 20th, 2009 was the 45th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. And we decided that, just for a whim, we would take our $10 app and make it free for the day. And so I, you know, set the price to zero on iTunes Connect. Emailed, you know, all of the folks in the sort of amateur astronomy media that I knew about, and went to sleep and woke up the next morning thinking that, you know, maybe we'd sell a few hundred free copies and that would get some of the word out. Well, lo and behold, the records from iTunes Connect came in the next day, and we had actually managed to sell 135,000 free copies.
Oh my goodness. So you must have been having convulsions about
that was,
dollar signs lost.
Look, that thought did cross my mind. Okay. But the next day, you know, we sold $8,000 worth of the app, and the next day it was like $3,000, and, you know, and it did, obviously it tailed off after that, but it got to the point where suddenly this was enough money that we could keep going. Like, mm-hmm. It was enough to pay, you know, pay rent and maybe not get the best food in San Francisco, but we could keep eating as we were going. Right. So that was a really big breakthrough. And I look back on it now, and we just sort of stumbled by sheer chance onto the viral nature of the internet. You know, you latch onto a popular or powerful news item, your little news item gets picked up and carried with it, and, you know, multiplied by all those, you know, news follower sites, and things get tweeted and blogged and reblogged. And so, lo and behold, you know, there's your marketing strategy.
Cool. Well, I want to follow up on that, but right now we have to take a break.
Okay.
Folks, when we return, I'll talk to Tim about what happened next. Folks, we will be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Tim DeBenedictis. Tim, so this sounds like a really exciting breakthrough for you. What happened next?
Well, there was some, obviously continued long-term, you know, growth in the app.
This is still Sky Voyager now, right?
This is Sky Voyager. We rebranded in, I want to say, about a year after this, July of 2010, to avoid some copyright. There's some Voyager as a different name owned by a different company, and we decided it would be easiest to just avoid that whole issue with the rebranding. That was challenging. You know, you get rid of a name, you think, oh geez, am I going to lose my user base? But
of course.
I'm sure that had an effect, but nevertheless, you know, we kept going. Two things that happened in this whole time frame was we, in addition to developing our app, we developed a hardware, an item, an accessory that bridged the gap between telescopes, which are usually very old RS-232 serial controlled devices, with the Wi-Fi capability built into iPhones. So the idea is that from your iPhone, you can now control your telescope as well as chart the sky. And that was a hardware development project. Those are a whole different, ball of challenges.
So what this allowed you to do basically was you could use the app on your phone to home in on an object you wanted to look at.
Exactly.
And then that would talk to the device through Wi-Fi and steer the telescope to those coordinates.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you tap on Mars on the screen. The phone sends a command to the telescope through our Wi-Fi box, and then the telescope, you know, goes and moves over to Mars. So that there's a combination of that hardware and the app was really new. That got a lot of attention, certainly in the astronomy world, and it also, you know, got some attention in the mainstream Mac world. We won a Best of Show at Mac World in 2010 for that combination of hardware and app. And that was really, you know, very cool, very mind-blowing, a lot of fun to be up there on stage and demonstrate that. But it also really kind of led to the growth of the business. We touched earlier on doing three flavors of our app, and this also happened around that time frame. As iPhones had gotten more powerful and processor speed grew and graphics capability grew, it struck me that, you know, it's now possible to have an iPhone app with the exact same level of, you know, fairly serious hardcore functionality that was previously only available on desktop astronomy software. Originally, our database was 10,000 stars, right? What you can see with your eyes. By mid-2011, you know, we had a version out that had a database of 15 million stars, the Hubble GuideStar catalog. This is a star database that'll let a serious observer go out and, say, hunt down the planet Pluto, which is a very, very, very faint object and a very deep, crowded star field.
Generally around 13.5 magnitude, right?
Yeah, 14.5 today. Pluto's getting a little further from the sun. Mm-hmm. So you know, our push in 2011 was to pretty much fully displace desktop astronomy software. And we decided also that, you know, listen, if we're going to have a premium product, let's price it at a premium price. And this to me was a little bit risky. I mean, you know, you have a $50 iPhone app in a world of $1 and $2 and free apps. I mean, how many people are going to buy this thing? I mean, how many people really care about this stuff? My expectation at the time was that we would sell, you know, maybe one or two of these high-end apps a day. When we launched it, you know, again, much to my surprise, we sold, you know, on the first day, we sold hundreds of this expensive app. And it eventually leveled off at, you know, dozens or, you know, maybe 50-ish copies a day. And
I think one of the things that helped was that I was following you at that time, and I was looking at your app and making a technical determination of it and reviewing it. And I said to myself, this guy really knows his celestial mechanics. And my guess is that the excellence of the program, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. and the knowledge that you brought to bear on the celestial mechanics and the accuracy of the application and its richness and its options telegraphed itself so clearly that the person goes, yeah, this is worth the money.
Well, you know, I think that's how we like to position ourselves. I mean, look, I was an MIT planetary science student. Getting things right was drilled into my head a long time ago. I mean, we tended to value accuracy over just, you know, eye candy. And yet, look, at the same time, if you do things right, the reality of astronomy is its own eye candy. And I think that, like you say, that telegraphed itself. I also, again, have to give, you know, a lot of thanks and props to Bill Shumi. Bill is just one of the most tireless, you know, hardworking people I know. He is just a relentless force of consumer advocacy. He did a great job helping us out, just reaching out to the serious amateur astronomy community. And honestly, Sky Safari would not be what it is without Bill's input as well.
Are you ready to talk about the ratio of sales of those three versions? I mean, does it go down as price you would expect, or is it evenly distributed?
Well, yeah, and obviously, volume-wise, we sell more on the low end. You know, we do have a $2 or $3 version of Sky Safari as well as the $50 version. You know, the $3 version does no telescope control. It only has the naked eye stars that, you know, the ones that you can see with your eyeball without a telescope. But, you know, we, like I say, volume-wise, the low-end version outsells the high-end version. But dollar-wise, the high-end version does better by quite a bit. This was surprising to me. I didn't think it was going to roll out this way.
Surprising to me, too.
Yeah. But, you know, look, in retrospect, when people want the best product out there, they are almost willing to pay any price for it.
Have you had any notable astronomers, people we've heard of and, you know, in the news say, hey, I downloaded this app, Tim. It's really cool.
I've had emails from Will Tyrian, who is the foremost astronomical cartographer. Nice. I've met Neil deGrasse Tyson, I don't know, enough times now that I suspect he has our app on his phone.
Oh, you met him in person?
Yeah, a couple of times. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, he's a fun guy. You know, and actually, it turns out I was on a road trip through the West not too many weekends ago and happened to stop at Lowell Observatory, right, which is a place that has a lot of personal import to me. And mm-hmm. Bumped into one of the astronomers that I'd worked with as a student. And at first, I'm like, well, he's going to even recognize me. Is he going to know who I am at this point? And he did, of course, and he talked, and it was great to catch up. And He said that when Lowell does public observatory nights, quote unquote, half the people there have your app, which was, you know, that felt great. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's just really great to have someone who was, you know, a mentor at a time in your life many years earlier come back to you. And you know, obviously he's been following what I did. That really felt good. And so there it is.
Awesome. Awesome. So this went on for a few years. And then there's the story with Simulation Curriculum.
Yes. Now, Simulation Curriculum is the publisher of a desktop astronomy software package called Starry Night. Starry Night is a tremendous program. In the early 90s, when I got started, you know, the king of the 800-pound gorilla of astronomy software was, in fact, Starry Night. Now, this again is in the early 90s. Some time had gone by between like 1994 and 2012, and sort of the market had shifted, right? Desktop software of all kinds. It was somewhat on the wane. I mean, not just through the growth of mobile, but also just web-based delivery, you know, like the internet
itself. And the introduction of the iPad in 2010, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, unbeknownst to me, Simulation Curriculum was looking for a way to get into the mobile market. They had a very good foothold in the desktop astronomy world, but again, that world is limited in scope and in size. And from my point of view, you know, I've been running the business in addition to writing code for 4 or 5 years now, and that is a lot of work. There's a lot of time that you spend talking with customers and going to trade shows, promoting your products, in addition to actually sitting down and writing the code. And it became clear to me that, like, at some point, I can't really grow this business a whole lot myself. I only have so many hours in the day, right? And we met with Simulation Curriculum at an astronomy trade show at the beginning of, 2012. And, you know, just sort of talked and sniffed around each other a bit. We kind of liked what we saw. They liked what they saw. And as discussion continued, it became clear that, well, let's try a merger. We fit a gap that they had, and they were able to, they being a somewhat larger company with more marketing, you know, outreach than we had, would be able to promote the product further. So that was really what led to the merger genesis in late 2012, early 2013.
So tell me about now the product profile. You mentioned Starry Night as the desktop app,
right?
Tell me about, are you still selling the Wi-Fi box, and are you still selling the 3 versions for iOS? And is there anything else?
Yes, we are, actually. In fact, the Wi-Fi box has been pretty much completely redesigned by Simulation Curriculum, almost without any real hands-on help from myself, which is really good. I mean, they've been able to take this design and run with it. Improvements are things like, you know, we've thrown away our disposable AA battery pack and replaced it with a 21st century lithium rechargeable pack, which you can now charge off your USB port. So that's sort of a nice touch. The Wi-Fi chipset has been revamped. It's now compatible with Android, which, of course, is another direction that Simulation Curriculum has carried things. Now, I should say, obviously, this is a Mac show. And at Apple-centric, we do spend, you know, a good amount of our time supporting Android as well. I will say that all of the stereotypes that people make about Android development compared to iOS development are 100% completely true in our experience. We spend about, you know, twice as much time supporting different flavors of Android. As much time supporting different flavors of Android in the you know, different OS versions, platform fragmentation, as we do on iPhones. We make about a third the revenue on Android that we do on iOS.
Do you have the same 3 levels of app on Android?
Yeah, we do. And in fact, the revenue within those tiers, the revenue split is very comparable. Again, it's the high end, which takes the majority of the revenue, even though the low end has higher, you know, unit volume.
Mm. Interesting. Interesting. What about the technical facilities for development, say Xcode compared to the development system in Android? How do you feel about the ease and the...
Yeah. Well, look, Xcode has gotten, you know, significantly more complex and slower over time. It's no longer quite as streamlined as it was, you know, say 5 or 6 years ago. But I think that's inevitable, given that the, you know, that the platform has just grown more complicated.
Yeah, but is it more of a joy to use?
Well, I'll say this: no matter how much I might complain about Xcode, it is light years better than Android Studio.
Okay.
You know, if I just look at launch times, right? I mean, Xcode launches on my, you know, not necessarily top of the line MacBook Pro in, I don't know, 3 or 4 seconds. Android Studio oftentimes is a, you know, get up and get a cup of coffee launch, particularly after a reboot.
Wow.
You know, we have a fairly complex project with a lot of, you know, native C++ code. There's a thick JNI layer. Again, I'm speaking about Android here. There's a thick JNI layer, which connects our underlying C++ core to the Android, you know, user interface classes, which are all in Java. And it's a complex project with a lot of code in it. the Android Studio tools are, you know, look, everything crashes from time to time. Android Studio crashes more often than Xcode. that's all I can tell you. We do Android because, you know, well, I mean, look, there's a lot of people out there in the world who have Android phones. Our problems as developers are not their problems, but we love what we do and we want to support them. And, you know, a lot of the Telescope vendors are looking for cross-platform support also. I mean, you know, again, their business is selling telescopes, optical hardware. They don't really care whether a customer is using that optical hardware in conjunction with an iPhone or an Android device. They just, you know, want to have their hardware used. And so, you know, when we made this move to support Android, it was sort of for a larger strategic purchase.
A lot of developers these days are confronted with and thinking about the subscription model that's available now in the App Store. How do you feel about whether this kind of app can benefit from a subscription model or not?
So it's funny you ask. We were actually having exactly this conversation internally at SCC about a week ago. I think this is interesting. You know, the hardest part of maintaining a complex technical app like the kind that we've got is that, you know, people, by and large, consumers think of apps as sort of the game model where things should be either free or very inexpensive and you just sell by volume. That's tough to do when you have such a niche specialty product. You know, our application is today as complicated as the most complicated desktop astronomy software. It supports a lot of third-party hardware. There's a lot of support work. There's a lot of, you know, just keeping up with changes in the OS is a big deal. Every time, you know, Apple revs iOS 8 to 9 to 10, something breaks, right? We've got to fix it.
And you've got to maintain that, and it costs money, but you don't necessarily see that in a brand new, exciting new version with new features.
Right, exactly. So, you know, our strategy has been to every, you know, 2 or 3 years, we release a major new version of Sky Safari with a new, you know, major version number.
Mm-hmm.
We sell that at a 50% discount for the first month and do our best to notify, you know, everyone out there that, hey, if you'd like to go forward, here's the new version and it's on sale at half off. And look, even for our pro version, half off translates to like $25. Okay. Now, which $25 sounds like a lot for an app. And, you know, sure, granted, for most apps it is. But in astronomy, you know, $25 is a sneeze, right? I mean, telescopes cost, well, $200 and on up. An eyepiece, even a decent, you know, mid-range eyepiece is like $50. You know, the most complex astronomy app
until
you can
get
buy.
Into those televiews, yeah. They're
$600. Sure, sure. I mean, there's no limit on the high end, right? So honestly, you know, at $25 or even $50, Sky Safari Pro is a fantastically good deal. You know, look, nevertheless, there are some people who will never in a million years think of paying $50 for an app, no matter how good it is. So I think, you know, for this kind of user, a subscription model may actually make more sense. I don't think that we will ever go exclusively one way or the other. I think we'll probably at some point offer a subscription model in addition to the all bells and whistles, you know, one-time purchase model. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly something that we're looking at very closely right now.
Interesting, interesting. Well, Tim, we're just about out of time. I have one more question for you.
Sure.
Without revealing any corporate secrets, is there anything at Simulation Curriculum that you'd like to tell us about, some hot projects or future plans? I'm just asking. You don't have to reveal anything.
No. Sure. I mean, look, I can say that, one thing we had talked earlier about was Pluto Safari, or planning to talk about was Pluto Safari, which was an app to sort of celebrate the New Horizons Pluto flyby. That app actually did, I think, better than any of us expected on the app stores. And so there is certainly some future plans for that app, not necessarily Pluto-centric. I can also say that we, on this same trip through the West recently, I happened to stop by Lowell Observatory, I also took a telescope in the back of the car, did some iPhone astrophotography. And, iPhone cameras are getting quite good now.
Oh, yes.
To the point where you can definitely take some not terribly bad quality images of some of the brighter deep sky objects.
And I'll get a tip in here for a friend, an amateur astronomer friend in Tucson, Mike Wiesner, who is an expert in iPhone astrophotography.
So I think these are things that we might want to explore in the future. So,
cool. All right. So folks are going to have to wrap it up here. This has been very interesting, Tim. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Sure. Well, the best way to get a hold of me, honestly, is just my email address. That would be I'll give you two email addresses. TimD@southernstars.com. And my simulation curriculum address is T de Benedictis. That's TDEBENEDICTIS @simulationcurriculum.com. That's a mouthful, so TimD@southernstars.com is probably easier.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Tim, thank you very much for being on the show. It's been a grand tour and an interesting history about your evolution as a developer in this great astronomy app. Thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. It's great to talk to you.
Folks, thank you for being on the show. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.